at that point falling and like trying to stretch out so I can get over the rocks, and I clip my butt on the last section of rocks, and I end up face down in the snow, and I roll over onto my back, and my leg is like a wet noodle across my chest, and my boot is up above my head.
What's up, everyone? You're listening to the Do Hard Things podcast by Elite SRS. The purpose of this show is to share stories of hardship and victory as an encouragement for those in the middle of their own hard thing. Because we know hardship produces perseverance, which produces character, which ultimately produces hope. Today's guest is Julian Carr. Julian is a professional skier and the founder of the Cirque Series, a high alpine race series spanning multiple countries and continents. Julian also holds the world record for the highest cliff jump in skiing, successfully jumping a 220-foot face. Julian shares about significant injuries, mental clarity, and the illuminated path forward. He also reminds us that taking risks and doing hard things should be done with 100% certainty of the outcome. If you enjoy the show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a review so more people can be encouraged by the stories we share. Now, here's the conversation with Julian Carr. All right, we got Julian Carr on the Do Hard Things podcast. Super excited to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, man. Honor to be a part of it. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, let's give some people some context for who you are. And I'll just ask you, when people ask you what you do, how do you answer that question?
I say, first of all, I'm lucky enough to have carved a path as a professional skier. And, it's been a decade plus. And, I'm in the ski industry known as the cliff guy. I kind of have some world records in cliff heights, but we can talk about all that later. I call that my baseball card stats. But I just love being in the mountains. In the summertime, I founded Cirque Series Mountain Races. So we get up into the same high alpine that we're up skiing in all the time. So just in the mountains year round, man, I love it.
Cirque Series Alpine Mountain Races, is that what you said it was? So is it just like a 10K type thing, or is it kind of off-road scramble stuff? What can you give me a sense of what it is?
I call them like a mini ultra. Okay. All races on average are about 15K and have 1,000 meters of elevation, and we always summit at least one peak. And they're usually, pretty iconic, high alpine, scrambly type peaks. And some of the routes we take have exposure. So they're very spicy, very hard, but very short races. So it's a fun challenge to have another excuse to drink a beer after a fun adventure in the mountains in the summertime.
So what's the next one on the docket? Where is it at?
First race out of seven starts July 1st, and then they wrap up late September. So basically every 2 weeks all summer long, we travel to different mountains all summer and produce a race every other weekend.
Wow. So July 1st, do you have the locations all picked out at this point?
Yep. Everything's launched on the website. Everyone can check it out on CirqueSeries.com. But we go to Switzerland, we go to Alaska, and all over the Western U.S. Rockies.
Wow. So this is quite the endeavor. It sounds like, how long ago did you start doing that?
I started the races in 2015. So we had to cancel 2020 due to COVID. But other than that, we're going into year seven, which is pretty wild that it's been that long. But it's really fun. I mean, I switched gears from skiing in April, May, and really lock on and really focus to execute the production. I'm hands-on race directing, and I've ran all the races, and I think we've produced almost 45 races now in over the last seven years.
That's so cool. So how many people typically will register and participate in one of those?
We have almost 4,000 runners per year amongst all the races.
So quite a few. Yeah. I'm trying to envision like hundreds of people running around in the Alpine. Like,
yeah.
Well, it's just not a normal sight,
I mean, we start at the bottom, and by the time we get up into the kind of technical terrain, there's very much an established pecking order at that point. And then obviously descend down, it's usually in a loop. So there's never real congestion or any bottlenecking, just the way that we kind of architect the races so that we're usually on like a service road for the first mile or two before we get into single track and technical terrain. And all the pros are just unbelievably fast. And then all the mortals after that. But at the same race, we'll have, you know, dad, grandpa, and grandson in the start gate next to an Olympian and like a ranked mountain runner. So for that rate, for an environment to make sense for kind of all walks of life, I think that's why our races are so fun, because we're not just bringing out quote unquote runner types, which they come out, which is great. We love them.
Yeah.
But we just kind of just get all walks of life, and it's pretty cool to see just, you know, the whole mix of people that are just stoked to come bag a peak, you know?
Right. Yeah. No kidding. So when you first envisioned it, you know, maybe 8-9 years ago, did you have a goal in mind of like 7 locations and growing it out? Or was it something you were just trying to figure out what to do in the summer? Like, how did it come about?
You know, it was, the races now are kind of at my vision. So the first few years when we were growing, you know, that was frustrating for me because I just had a bigger vision for what the races could be. And I've produced every race since the first year to, you know, facilitate the vision of, you know, lots of vendors and sponsors in the finish line, world-class announcer, world-class music, food, beverages, and just a really fun atmosphere. And, you know, those first few years building up the brand was obviously lots of lessons learned. And now here we are, like everything's at my vision, which is, you know, very gratifying. I think I always envisioned it being global. I always envisioned it being like sold out races, which we're doing. And it's kind of all coming together, which is, you know, obviously very gratifying and very, it's just a nice affirmation. And seeing so many people have so much fun is just like motivating to continue to put a ton of energy into the races, because it's just, you know, it's amazing to feel people having a good time, like genuine happiness, you know?
Right. No, that's really cool. And I'm selfishly asking you a little bit, like for us as a company, we started an event we call Jump Rope Weekend, and you know, we're 1 year in and we've got this like grand vision. And it's interesting just to hear you talk about, right? Like it was frustrating the first few years, like you had a vision and you kept living into it like it was a reality, but it took, I don't know when, you know, it became reality. It sounds like now, you know, you're 7 for sure. But it took a few years, and just like the grind that it takes to build something, you know, it's like not overnight. But yeah. What kept you going?
I think the people that did come, I could tell, had genuine happiness. You know, they really enjoyed themselves, because we produced the race to be at scale. And yeah. So, you know, each year, you know, the numbers doubled until we started selling them out just in our third year. So just those first couple of years, even though for the smaller attendance that we had, you could just feel that it had amazing momentum. So I think that really helped propel the energy and the motivation to keep moving forward. Even though we didn't make any money those first couple of years, I just knew that everything was coming together. I could feel it, you know?
Yeah. So cool. Well, yeah, congratulations on creating some fun for people. And meaningful.
It's fun. A nice way to, you know, be in the high alpine and lend my, you know, just kind of fluency or expertise or whatever you want to say of, you know, traveling through the mountains in the winter, and obviously colder temperatures is a whole different ball game.
Right.
I'm so used to that. So to be able to share my love of the high alpine and produce races in a safe way, to share that kind of cool energy of the high alpine is just amazing, because so many people that come out for the races, it's their first time truly going into those types of mountains and terrain and summits, and to see people have that kind of discovery is pretty magical. And then obviously all the guys that are used to it, it's just fun to see people enjoy a challenge and then And to watch the pros and to be blown away by how unbelievably fast they are and see them endorse our races too, like people that are kind of, you know, professional runners that have done every kind of race under the sun, and to have them come back year after year and to endorse our races amongst the spectrum of mountain running race scene is huge.
Yeah.
So to know that we're carving out a nice little niche that, you know, people that have a lot of history with running these races, these types of races, really, really like what we're doing. And we get a lot of great feedback from people that, you know, have a pretty huge resume. So that's also motivating.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. You get that social affirmation from people who actually know it. Like, it's not just some person saying, oh yeah, I adore it. It's like somebody who's done tons of this stuff that, their voice matters a lot. So yeah, that would be super encouraging.
Yeah.
In this episode, Julian and I talk briefly about founding an event and the journey from idea to making your revision a reality. Starting your own event is a ton of fun, and we want you to join us for ours. Head over to EliteSRS.com and check out our event, Jump Rope Weekend, and be sure to join us this Memorial Day in beautiful Leavenworth, Washington. Learn jump rope from the best coaches in the world, meet your new best friend, and have your mind blown at the throwdown where 8 athletes battle head-to-head in a winner-take-all competition. Register now at EliteSRS.com/JumpRopeWeekend. So you said that you're known as the cliff guy or cliff man or something like that. I mean, that's kind of a not normal title for somebody, I suppose. But can you explain what that is or where it came from?
Sure. You know, going back to when I was a kid, I did a lot of gymnastics and I didn't start skiing till 8th grade. So my whole childhood, I did all kinds of sports, but one thing I really loved was gymnastics, and I got addicted to jumping into the foam pit.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'd jump on the trampoline in the foam pit. I would, before the instructors would come in, I'd sneak up into the rafters and drop like 40, 50 feet into the foam pit. And ever since I was little, I just had like this innate, you know, understanding of how to relax into the foam pit and not feel a thing. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And so, you know, fast forward to 8th grade and I went skiing, grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah. So obviously tons of amazing powder at all the Utah resorts.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the first time I skied, basically, I mean, I already fell in love with the mechanics of like turning on a groomer. And then the first time I skied powder, like truly deep powder, you know, the whole like light bulb went off where I was like, oh my gosh, deep powder is literally, it's not different to a foam pit. It's the same thing. So my vision when I'm out cruising around in the mountains, you know, is instead of seeing like a dangerous landing, I literally see a never ending foam pit for a landing. But to develop the skills and the patience, and the, you know, the ability to critically assess when your life depends on it is taking me my entire life of, you know, kind of lots of failures, plenty of success, but, you know, obviously it didn't happen overnight. And, you know, I broke my femur once, and actually wasn't from jumping cliffs. But that femur break really led me to make better decisions. And that was before I was really even jumping big cliffs. And funny enough that the clarity I had from breaking my femur led me down this path of really good decision-making, that actually led to me making these like really conscious, clear, present, aware choices to actually hit big cliffs, because I was so present and so aware and so in tune with making better decisions that I like just dove deep into what it looked like to jump big cliffs, and realized that although it was scary, I could think through that fear.
Yeah.
Clarity of just like, I can do this. And so it was weird. If I would have never broke my femur, I don't think I would have ever explored big cliffs, and and I've ticked off at least 50 cliffs that are over 100 feet, and the biggest one around 220 feet front flip. I've done in contests and all over the world, and it's just this interesting space that I like to explore. And obviously, the physical aspect of that is obvious and super fun. There's nothing like swan diving off a 100-foot rock into the sky with 100% confidence, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the mental part of it too is as intense, if not more, than the physical part of it. And I really think the mental part is really where you transcend kind of some normal human experiences, for time warp, for meditation. You know, for me, it's like a act of artistry where I take my mind and my body, and certainly not a bang your chest and slam a Mountain Dew kind of mentality at all. You know, I'm really there to be in tune with my surroundings and share the secrets of nature and blend in with it. Definitely not up there to conquer, you know?
Right. Okay, there's so many things that you just said that we could probably get into. So I'm curious first. So actually, before I even ask that, did you break your femur before you ever did like one of those 100-foot cliffs?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was just like 4 or 5 years into skiing at that point. And
okay.
It was actually
professionally, or like this was in high school?
It was the first year, maybe second year of college. And it was actually the first year that I got sponsors as a skier. And I was taking like my preseason training super seriously. I was skiing super well. But I kind of had like this 99% rule where I was like, I'll drop in anything and I'm 99% sure I'm going to pull it off. And so when the 1% would happen, which was maybe only a couple times a year, I'd have some really, really spectacular crashes. And, you know, for anyone that skis or snowboards knows that you can have really spectacular crashes and walk away completely unscathed. And so that's kind of where all my experiences as a skier had been up to that point, was that 99% of the time I just figure it out real time and rely on my skills to pull off whatever it is I was interested in. And then every once in a while I did have some really, really spectacular crashes that I walked away from, no problem, just laughed it off. This one time, it was the first day of the year, snowed 100 inches in 3 days and it snowbird Utah.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was first day, took preseason training super seriously. I had got some sponsors in the off season. I was just gonna, you know, in my mind, take over the whole ski scene. I was gonna take it over, you know, like
that's where
my mind was at. So day one, I'm skiing like super well. I'm skiing lines that usually I'm not doing till like midwinter. And you know, it's getting towards the end of the day. And I meet up with these two guys and I'm like, oh, you gotta come check out this line I skied earlier today. And they're like, all right, let's go. So we go over there, and yeah, earlier in the day I went and lined up this really technical, just like really rocky area. Like, just it was really fast, kind of like double, I don't even want to call it a cliff. There's just a lot of rocks, and you had to pick your skis up over two different areas. So it's kind of like a double cliff, but going really fast. And I did it earlier in the day and I aced it. And I was like, I'm feeling great. I would never do this line until season, you know. So I meet up my buddies, I bring them over there, and we pull up. Before they could even start to think, like, holy shit, I just was like, I'm going to drop in and
involve
with these guys, you know? And so I drop in without really focusing on what I was doing. And I got off the first little cliffy rock area off balance and landed in a way that all my energy was like putting me over the handlebars of a bike, you know?
Yeah.
And so I didn't have any pop to get over the next section of rocks. And, you know, I'm kind of, at that point, falling and like trying to stretch out so I can get over the rocks, and I clip my butt on the last section of rocks, and I end up face down in the snow. And instantly I was like, oh my God, I just hit my ass so hard. I think I just bruised my ass unbelievably bad. and I roll over onto my back, and my leg is like a wet noodle across my chest, and my boot is up above my head. So I just have this wet noodle of my entire leg.
Oh my goodness.
My body and my boots up by my head. So anyway, I, you know, grabbed my leg and like plopped it down in the snow and like piled snow underneath it to like put it in the alignment of where it should be. And that maybe took 5 seconds, but all I could think of was, can you move your toes? Can you move your toes?
Yeah.
As soon as I got my leg stabilized, I like took a deep breath and tried to move my toes, and I could. So I was like, okay, that's good. and then I was like, man, if I start feeling dizzy or, you know, anything like that, that means I probably severed an artery internally, and this is going to get. And I just, you know, kept feeling alert. And my friends got down to me, came down and around, and they were calling for help. Everything was super, you know, there's lots of clarity, and I wasn't losing any kind of, So I was like, okay, I think they didn't have that happen either. So anyway, they, you know, super long story short, they got me down, did the x-rays, because they didn't know if I broke my hip, my pelvis, my femur, all the above. And I ended up breaking my femur in 11 pieces. And it was just like 2 inches underneath where the femoral bone like connects into your hip socket.
Yeah.
So they said it was just really tricky. And they showed me like how, you know, 4 or 5 of the bone fragments came within, you know, a couple of millimeters of nicking my femoral artery. And they're like, it's just amazing that it didn't.
Yeah, no kidding. It was
just a little nick from any of these little fragments. And it happens so high up in my body that's where all the really tight muscle attachments are and everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got a great surgeon, just dedicated myself for, you know, 5 straight months to 8 hours a day of physical therapy and eating right. And that was my approach. And when I kind of got back on my skis, they said it might not be a couple of years till I got on my skis, and I skied that spring. So what? I was beyond dedicated. Yeah. So I skied some groomers that spring. The next winter comes around, I'm back to 100% because I spent all summer just strength training. And, you know, I kind of had a conversation with myself, and I was like, okay, you obviously love skiing, and this is obviously really dangerous. You have to be a better decision maker. There's just no way you can go down this path with the kind of, you know, my whole like approach up to that point. I just knew I had to make some serious adjustments, you know. So I did. I just made a promise to myself that I was like, you're just not going to do things unless you have 100% clarity. And so that was obviously an interesting next winter, getting back into the swing of things, because at that time, I mean, I guess the sport still is progressing, you know, at a lightning pace, but at that time it was even crazier. Like every year seemed like there's so much progression in the sport. So missing an entire year and then getting back on my feet the next year, it was just an interesting year to start exploring, you know, 20, 30 foot cliffs, and kind of the biggest I'd ever done was 40, maybe 50 feet. And just even think about doing a cliff bigger than that was, you know, get your heart rate going. But I was really infatuated with big cliffs. And at the time, there's another professional skier, this guy named Jamie Pierre, that was in like every movie, every magazine, and he'd cracked the code. He was hitting, you know, 80 to 150 foot cliffs multiple times every season. And I was just like, how is this guy figuring this out? And if he can figure it out, I can figure it out, you know? So for, you know, an entire summer, that next summer, I went and like hiked up to the takeoffs of some of these big cliffs and just kind of sat there cross-legged and try to take in what it felt like to be in such an intense spot, you know?
Yeah.
And I just I just couldn't. And the next winter came around and, you know, maybe hit a 40, 50 footer, just still couldn't wrap my head around how to do a bigger cliff. I was just too scared. And finally I kind of figured it out. And the whole aha moment for me was, you know, if I hit a 40 foot cliff, I'm maybe in the air for like 1 second.
Yeah.
You know, that's a pretty long, intense journey of 1 second where you have to be just completely balanced, really relaxed. And then when you come in contact with deep powder, you just relax with it. So you have no impact and you, you know, don't feel anything, just like a foam pit.
Yeah.
And I realized, I was like, you know what? If I can just stay composed in the air for like 0.5 seconds longer, maybe one more second, I'm like, after you drop 40 feet, your speed increases pretty quickly. So I'm like, although it takes 1 second to do 40 feet, it's probably only going to take a half a second to do another 40 feet. So I was kind of like, okay, if I can just be composed in the air for literally a half a second, that's the gateway to go from exploring 40 foot cliffs comfortably to, you know, 80, 90 foot cliffs comfortably. So that really resonated with me. So the next winter, I'm up for a sunrise shoot and we're treading some deep pow and we come down around this corner and I can tell we're approaching the top of a big cliff and everybody skied around it. But I was like, hey, when you go around the corner there, I'm going to be up on the top of this, whatever this is. If there's a takeoff and we can communicate, you know, let's have a look at this. And so my buddies were like, okay. And sure enough, they go down there. I'm looking off the cliff. They're so far down there. I'm like, oh my gosh, heart rate's going crazy. So I'm like, all right, first things first, probe the landing, you know? So
yeah,
I go down, probe the landing and, you know, put my whole being into it. It wasn't just like probing a landing for, I wonder how deep the snow is. I was like, okay, can I land in the snow and not get hurt? Like,
right.
The really approach that kind of decision making was just kind of a whole new ball game. It was really intense, you know, because I'd obviously probe landings for 40 foot cliffs, but this cliff was, you know, for sure 80, 90 feet.
Yeah.
And so that was really interesting because I probed it till I was like, okay, I definitely think I can land in this for sure. Like there's no doubt in my mind. And then I started to hike back up and then I'm like, wait a minute. Once you go back up there, you know, this memory of probing this landing is going to feel like, are you sure? So I went back in and I was like, okay, I have absolute clarity that I feel comfortable that I can jump into the snow.
Yeah.
And so I hiked back up and I ski back to the takeoff, heart rate's going crazy, like off the charts heart rate. And I'm like, God, man, this is so scary. And then like looking off the cliff and I'm like, all right, next time. That's like what went through my head. Like, this is just too scary, next time. So I like was pointing my skis to ski out of there, ski around and meet up with my friends. And just something in me was like, dude, if you're interested in these big cliffs and you've been so interested in them now for years, you put so much time into it that I was like, it just hit me. I was like, this is always going to be scary.
Yeah.
It's never not going to be scary. What is scaring you? You know, like what exactly is scaring you? And so I stepped back into the takeoff area and I was by myself because all my friends were down in the landing.
Uh-huh.
And I just told them I just needed a little while. And they're like, dude, take your time. All good.
Yeah.
So I'm up there, heart rate's going crazy. And I just lay down on the snow and like look up into the clouds and I take deep breaths and just really tried to like figure out what I was scared of. And all I could figure out was that it was scary. And so I'm like, all right, well, what can I do this then? Do I have the skills to actually execute this cliff and be comfortable in the air for 2 seconds and land in the snow in a way that I won't get hurt? And the more I focused on the one path of how to do it and not get hurt, and kind of just shield it out. I was aware of all the wrong paths and how you could get hurt, what could go wrong, but I really just illuminated the right path, the one way you can do it. And from really focusing on that, I really found this nice clarity, and I was able to like convert that fear really genuinely turn into confidence. And it was really magical. And it was this really interesting, you know, transformation of pure fear that really through critical thinking and focusing on that illuminated path, I completely converted pure fear into pure confidence. And I was completely calm. And I was in a kind of just state of like hyper awareness where that path, like I said, was just illuminated, and I was calm and I was confident. And then I had this other thought. I was like, man, you're 100%. I'm like, yeah. That promise you gave yourself, you'd be dishonoring yourself if you didn't do this, because you are 100%. And so, yeah, I radioed down to my buddies and I'm like, okay, guys, I'm 100%. I'm, you know, 2 minutes out. I'll get back on the radio and I'm like 30 seconds, but I'm going. And they're like, yeah, okay, man, awesome. And I shit you not, I put away my radio and I'm like, you know, minute out, doing like the final zipper checks, breathing deep, feeling amazing. Of all the people, we're out in the backcountry. The guy, Jamie Pierre, shows up.
No, sir. Are you serious?
Yeah. And he pulls up and he sees what I'm kind of doing. And he's like, hey, man, this is awesome. He's like, I'll get out of your way. He's like, do you mind if I hit this after you? And I was like, absolutely. And he's like, cool, man, my name's Jamie. And I was like, what's up, Jamie? Julian. He's like, sick. So he gets out of the way and, you know, didn't shake the focus that I had. It was just the supreme awareness. And anyway, I gave the 30 seconds and, you know, confidently skied towards the cliff, got the perfect amount of pop, got into the sky. I was completely balanced, did everything perfectly, just like I knew I would. Like I'd visualized, you know, 100 times takeoff, relaxed into the landing, skied away in one continuous motion, just laughing because I didn't feel a thing, number one. And then number two, I was like, oh man, there is no limit to the height. Like, and so right then and there, I was like, oh, this is just the beginning. So after that, wow. After that really amazing experience, I was right, because never has it never not been scary. Every single time it's really intense, and it takes everything I have to sit with the fear every time. You know, and sometimes when I sit with the fear, I start to understand what's scary, and it's for a reason, and I'll walk away from a lot of cliffs. But you know, when I'm able to sit with things and critically assess the landing, the takeoff, the sheerness of the cliff, and obviously the general safety of location and adventure and all that kind of stuff. But once all those things clear that kind of fear conversion into confidence, it's just this amazing clarity that gives me this really fun mental kind of state that I've never experienced in life, and it's just profound. And and then obviously the physical part of shooting out into the sky and seeing the ground and possibly far distance away also, you know, the physical part is unbelievably fun too, but that mental part is so intense and so you know, I don't know what the right word is, it's just, it's magical, you know.
Yeah. You're a really good storyteller. That was you know, riveting just to listen to it. Thanks for all the detail, because it like lets me be there, you know? And
thanks, I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was like, I'm just trying to imagine, you know, like sitting up there. So literally for me right now, I'm like, I want to do a backflip, just like on flat ground. And there's the mental block of like, I'm going to smash my head into the ground when I do it, you know? And like, not at any point is it the same scale of what you're doing, but the mental block is this, like, you know, it's scary. And it's just fun listening to the way you processed it. Like, I'm going to go try to apply that a little bit to doing a backflip and being 100% certain, I think is an important part of it. But it's like a good blueprint too, you know, like you just outlined a really good blueprint for doing hard things in a like reasonably safe way, considering they're hard, you know, like there's a reason they are. But
totally. I think that mindset and those steps and kind of the 100% thing has helped me, you know, like with some of the businesses I've founded, that approach to, you know what you're landing in. You know, don't just drop in 99% sure you're gonna pull it off. So it's like, really, it's helped me apply and navigate life in general.
Yeah. So I feel like there's a lot of applications, and that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, okay, so it's clear how you've been able to apply that now into jumping off really high cliffs into the snow, into a foam pit, basically.
Yeah.
But like, how have you been able to apply that, you know, practically into the other things that you've done in your life and seen it kind of like spill over, so to speak? You mentioned your businesses, but, you know, is that equally scary in a different way, you know, starting those things, or are there other things where you've been just as terrified to do them? And, you know, you've needed to like sit on the cliff laying down and look at the clouds, you know, and just process everything.
Yeah. I think really the whole lesson of big cliffs and the way I approach them, it's just led me to like live a more like mindful, like positive life. I think, you know, any situation you get into as a human, you have your own perspective and obviously everyone else's perspective. And I think it really just has helped me navigate life, trying to think from so many more perspectives than my own. And also just see things for kind of like their natural state or natural progression. Because when I'm out there in nature, I'm really just trying to fit into, you know, the current energy and be a part of it. So I think when you read a room, whether business, relationships, friends, you know, there's just like a nice present state of things. And if you can read the room and think from other perspectives of your own, I think it just leads you to a more mindful life and you're able to, you know, kind of just proceed in a way that you're reasonable. And you know, when you need to negotiate, you are able to think from the other person's perspective so that you're kind of already articulating a win-win. And obviously that applies to business, but I think it applies to life in general too.
Well, it's so interesting that you're talking about this because I'm watching this masterclass with this guy named Daniel Pink, it's on sales and persuasion. Like that's his shtick. And the most recent one I watched, he talked about attunement was the word he used, but being able to see from someone else's perspective. And he said there's an inverse relationship between power, either you feel like you have a lot of power or you actually do, and your ability to take someone else's perspective. The more power you feel like you have, the less likely you are or are able to take someone's perspective. And I'm a dad of four little kids, and I immediately thought of that relationship. Like I have a ton of power as a dad of for little kids, and how rarely I take their perspective. Like I'm just like, when I want to persuade them, I just turn up the power knob. But his argument is like, no, like turn down the power to be more effective. And I'm thinking about your cliff jumping, you know, like who has the power? Nature, like the cliff, you know, like you have no power going over that cliff. And in regard to the, you know, the fall and everything else, and like you have to turn down your power in the sense that like, you know, you're invincible, right? To be able to like be more effective. And
that's fascinating. What was the guy's name again?
His name's Daniel Pink. So
well, that's why I think, you know, in the ski industry, action sports, there's a lot of really talented humans obviously that exist in those spaces. And some come along that have this unbelievable skill set, but I think they do exist in that paradigm of turning up their power volume. And you see you know, some spectacular injuries or spectacular personalities that are hard to work with. So as far as being a professional, they have that inability to fit in because they're, you know, they have that power volume so high up that they either get a serious injury that they aren't able to get back from, or professionally they just can't adapt. Or their personalities clashes with too many people, so they're not going to get called back for jobs and stuff like that. Because I think that's one of the fascinating things about being a professional athlete is obviously the athletic part of it is fun and obvious, but you know, behind the scenes to build a, you know, decade plus career, it's definitely, you know, you have to rely on your professionalism. And you know, that's a whole another part of the equation that I think it's overlooked or is a big turnoff to a lot of people that show up that might have this tremendous skill set, but they don't really have a shelf life because they never really try to optimize their professionalism. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Cause you don't live in a bubble, right? Like it's there inevitably it's an interpersonal pursuit. Like it may be a singular athlete like activity, but people are involved like in all the facets of that career. So
it's cool to I just like the way you brought the humanity into making that reference with the other guy, Dan Pink, is that what you said his name is?
Yeah I can send it to you after too. So you have it.
I think there's so much humanity in any career, right? Because I think people put professional, you know, action sport athletes into this category of, you know, quote unquote, living the dream. They're so lucky. And it's like, oh, I agree. But, you know, the majority of anyone that's existing in that space, they're still just a human. And I promise you, they're working their asses off behind the scenes, other than just, you know, the cool stuff you see in magazines or movies or whatever, you know?
Yeah, totally. And they didn't just like show up one day and land that like it was a grind to get there. And I think especially for, you know, like someone like yourself, like there's the mainstream sports, you know, the footballs and the basketballs and, you know, this like celebrity status kind of across cultures. And then there's the niche professional sports, but like everything is like, you just got to earn it a lot more than you have to necessarily. And I'm not discrediting, you know, an NFL player's at work ethic or anything like that, but there's just more resources available there than there are in a lot of these other professional endeavors, you know, like the runners you were mentioning before. It's just more of a grind to like sell yourself to a business for sponsorship, or like the money's just not free flowing, you know?
Yeah. So that's definitely accurate. I think when you get fit into traditional team sports, obviously you could say it's maybe more competitive, but you know, you're kind of put into a marketing machine and you have a nice guaranteed salary, but action sports, like you have to, you know, be so self-starter. And the way I look at it is like, you need a story to tell. You know, and you're kind of that template for the brands that you work with, because they trust that you can get some exposure for their products and logos through your storytelling. And obviously storytelling means fitting into traditional media in the outdoor industry, and obviously generating and producing your own, you know. And
right,
that's where the other side of the equation is that to be an action sport athlete, other than, you know, if you're these days in an Olympic discipline, other than that, you really need to be very efficient at production and thinking of your own ideas and to generate projects and to generate like actual productions. Like it's so much professionalism that goes into that, but I enjoy it and it's fun. But it's a lot that goes into it.
Yeah. So we've been talking about this like really compelling story, but you know, I haven't asked like our central question, and I have to ask it because I don't know if, you know, the answer to the question is the same as what we've already discussed. So I'm going to ask it. And if it's the same, it's totally cool. But, you know, this podcast is built on the idea of encouraging people in a hard season through the difficult stories that people have been through, because it's hard to like find the perspective and the hope in the middle of it. But oftentimes those stories can kind of like shine a light into the valley. And so the question that we ask is, what's the hardest thing in your life you wouldn't take back and why?
Man, I think, believe it or not, I actually had another injury after the femur injury.
And before you started doing cliffs or?
No, this was after.
Okay.
This is well into it. This is, you know, after I ticked off even the 200 footer. And I was living by the 100% or don't do it.
Yeah. Code.
And I was out on a film production with Warren Miller, and we were in this beautiful area in the backcountry. And there's this, you know, 1,000 feet of vert beneath me. The filmer was across the valley, and he was just going to film me kind of having some nice high speed, really just kind of chill, fun powder turns down this big face. And me, I instantly was like, oh yeah, I'm just going to make some fun powder turns, like no problem. And I knew there was one tree down 3/4 of the way down this slope, and I couldn't see it from up there because of the rollover status, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I'll see it when I start skiing, you know? So 3, 2, 1, filming, start skiing, open it up, going fast, making some amazing, fun, high speed pow turns. And just GS style, going like 40 miles per hour down this kind of steep face. And I come over this tiny little rollover. I'm like, all right, I'm gonna see that tree. And instead of like having any time to react, the tree is, I can't avoid it. And so I lift my legs up to try to minimize the impact and just smash my knees against my chest. I can feel and hear what sounded like every ligament in my knee ripping apart. And I, you know, crashed, came to a rest. The pain was so unbelievably bad. And I could feel everything that ripped. And I was just in shock. I was like, did that really just happen?
Yeah.
Did I really just completely blow my knee skiing pow? Like in the most non-consequential kind of thing.
Yeah.
Same thing, we're really far out there. It took 3 hours or so for ski patrol from the neighboring ski resort to come out to me, luckily.
Yeah.
And I was getting really cold, all that kind of stuff. And anytime I'd even have a micro adjustment, I had the most excruciating pain. And so same thing, the kind of initial analysis was like tib fib break plus blew out probably every ligament plus meniscus, all that stuff.
And yeah.
I just can't believe it. And they get me down. They stay the night in the hospital. They do the MRI. I ended up tearing my ACL, PCL, LCL, meniscus, and I tore my calf muscle.
Oh, so the only
thing, the only thing I had left was my MCL.
Wow.
And the pain from that whole experience is so extraordinary because the femur break was also really painful. And it was like this really kind of low pitched pain that I can't really explain. I never felt it before.
Like a dull kind of pain?
Like so dull and like such a low frequency kind of like unbelievable ache. Like not comfortable. I never thought I'd feel anything is more uncomfortable than that until my knee. And it was just the most high frequency kind of pain you can imagine. And oh my gosh, it was so painful. So I go into the doctor, I get a US ski team surgeon that's, you know, done every kind of Olympian you can imagine. And he comes in and sees me before surgery. And he's like, hey, Julie, nice to meet you. You know, like, I just want to be real with you. I know the kind of skiing you like to do. He's like, you know, I think you got a really long road ahead of you, and I just don't want to put any false expectations. You know, you might not get back to where you want to be.
Yeah.
So to hear that from that kind of a surgeon, I just looked at him and was like, try to process what he was saying. And I just said, hey, you basically have 4 different surgeries that you need to perform on me. And you've performed all 4 of these surgeries on 4 separate people, and they've all came back to be 100%, correct? He's like, yes, that's correct. I'm like, well, when you go in there, this is not one surgery. I'm like, every time when you fix the one thing, I need you to refocus, and you're starting a whole new surgery on a whole new person. I'm like, if you can have that mindset, if you can patch me up to the best of your ability, I'll take care of the physical therapy. And he's like, I don't like that perspective. Like, deal. So anyway, we do surgery. I'm out of it. But my dad said when he came in after surgery, he popped his head in, and he's like, tell Julian I did my four jobs. Now it's his turn. So, I mean, I put so much energy into my femur recovery that I was already kind of had the right mindset on how to approach it. But this is a whole new ball game, because the femur surgery was like, you know, the bone needed to heal and I needed to stimulate the muscle attachments. And, you know, I was kind of on my way. So with the knee, having three ligaments, the meniscus and the calf muscle is just, is really, really intense. So I would bike to physical therapy. I do physical therapy for 3 to 5 hours a day. And then I would bike to the gym and I'd crutch around and just do upper body stuff. And then I would go to either acupuncture, Reiki, or Rolfing afterwards. So from basically 8 a.m. until 6 or 7 p.m., 5 or 6, sometimes 7 days a week, I was on that program. And I knew to the millimeter all of my progress, my charts for the week of how much flexion and strength and you know, muscle mass or atrophy, all that kind of stuff. So like all the physical therapists were just like, I just knew our goals. I knew where we were going. Yeah. Push it either, because obviously you can really stall your healing strategy too much. So it's just this, I really immersed myself, I mean, times 10 from what I did with my femur. And, you know, the femur, but definitely the knee, because the femur, I kind of just, I could feel that I was going to be okay. And the surgery went great. And then I just understood that it was like a bone needed to heal. And then kind of a straightforward path to healing. And even the doctors, even though they said it might take me a couple of years, which I did it quicker, they, you know, they had no doubt I'd be 100% back on my feet. So, but to hear this US ski team surgeon tell me flat out that I might not get back to where I wanted to be, like, I just love movement. I love being athletic. And at that point, it wasn't even my ski career I was thinking about. It was me and my life and how I would be for the rest of my life, you know, movement. And it's just so important to me. And so to really dedicate myself to that extent really felt amazing. And same thing, it just built, I would say I wouldn't take it back, because you know, at that point I was already making good decisions as a skier, but I obviously the one time I let my guard down, I paid the price for it, but that was kind of all skiing minded stuff. And obviously it trickled into my life in general, but you know, this, the knee thing really gave me this nice, I would just say like, it just built my character. I wouldn't take it back. And I think it really gave me this, unshakable appreciation and like gratefulness for movement and an athlete and getting my speed career back and actually getting to 100%. Like, I just don't take it for granted. And I just am really grateful and like have more intent in life, because I really felt what it could have been to take some of my mobility away. And that's like the one thing I love in life the most, not just for my speed career, but just the way I like to live life. So I definitely wouldn't take it away, because it's really helped me really appreciate life in general by having to work through that whole experience.
Yeah. So what was harder, the mental struggle of, you know, being told probably not happening anymore, and like that, like, what's my life going to be kind of played out in the future worry, or the physical just like pain of going through rehab? And maybe it's not a fair comparison, but, you know, when you think back on that, what do you recall?
I'd say they were just both so intertwined. It took everything I had, both, that I was just focused again. I just illuminated that path to healing. I put everything I had physically, mentally into it. I even like would visualize like oceans of like cartilage and blood and like going around all my cartilage attachments and my joints and just my blood, just myself in general. I was so into the challenge. I was so invested in it that, you know, like I said, it built my character and I could feel it happening. So while it was all happening, it was just this really intense journey, you know, for me, like just as who am I? Like deep down, yeah. I really had to dig deep to heal. And it took everything I had physically and mentally. So both.
Totally. Yeah. So do you think the vision that you had for what you wanted your future to be that had kind of been stripped away, you know, and who you thought you were in the moment that it happened and was happening is what was compelling you? Like, or do you think it was some of your character that you had built previously? Like what was, because not everybody responds to adversity and someone telling them this isn't going to happen the way that you did. Right. So what was it that was like the driving force to like wake up every day, 8 to 6 p.m., bike, PT, bike, gym, bike, like grind it out?
I think it was going back to being a kid and just, you know, going on long hikes with my dad, playing soccer, football, basketball, skateboarding, and just my future and all the activity and movement that's always been a part of my life. I think it was just this deep awareness of knowing I loved a life of movement and that I was going to make sure that I had a future of movement. And I think that connection and that appreciation of just, being really, I keep saying grateful, but it's just, that's the reality. I was just like, I love being, I love moving and I can't imagine not having it. And so I'm going to do everything I possibly can. And I'm going to do it. That's the thing. I was like, I think that's where my peace was. I was like, if I do everything I can mentally and physically and put my absolute 100% heart, soul, everything into healing, where that leads me, if it's 95% of what I used to be or 80% of what I used to be, I'll have a peace of mind because I did put everything into it. And that's what I was moving towards. I knew that if I ended up with some kind of chronic impairment to my mobility and the only thing to blame was my inability to put everything I had into physical therapy, I would never have had peace of mind, you know?
Right.
And I've seen people that have had injuries that don't put everything they have into their healing and they do end up with something chronic, and man, it's hard to watch because I'm like, you could have avoided that, my friend, you know?
Right. Yeah. So there's like a, you don't want to live in regret, like kind of mentality of like, what if I had, you know,
exactly. Put everything into it. So I knew that wherever the dust settled, that would be my peace of mind. And I tell you what, though, the next winter, I was back to skiing 100%.
That's what I was going to ask you. Did you get all the way back? What was the final percent?
I did, man. I was back and still am. Like I said, I'm so appreciative of it. And I know that I dug deep and put everything I had into the healing.
Mm. Did you ever talk to that surgeon again?
Yeah. I came back, gave him a poster he put on his wall. And people that go in there say that poster's still up.
Oh, cool.
I kept in touch with him for a few years.
Yeah. He obviously did a good job. So I keep envisioning, I got two more questions for you. I keep envisioning your, like, close everything off and illuminate the path, like the single path.
Yep.
It's a really powerful image, I think. You know, and what's in my mind, even just taking back to the cliff story is, you're up on the cliff, there's this cliff sky, it's all bright, snowy. And then it all goes dark and there's just like this, it's almost like a video game, right? Like it's just like gold path. Boop, 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 boop. And it just like, it's the only way to go. And it's super clear. I'm curious how you envision it. Cause like, that's what's in my head. But when you're talking about like only envisioning this one thing, what's it look like? Like, can you just kind of like peel back the layers a little bit?
I would say that what you just said is, you know, kind of accurate, but I will say that it's not like I've used the term, be careful about being blindly optimistic. So although the right path, the one way you can do it is the focus, you know, you're at the same time very aware of the ways it can go wrong. And you've certainly visualized all those, you know, thousands of paths that it can go wrong. And you're very much as aware of those paths as you are the illuminated one, but you choose to focus on that path, on the how you do it path, while being as aware as the wrong of the wrong path. So it's not this blindly optimistic, I'm just going to focus on this and not be completely aware of how you can make the mistakes. You need to be just as focused on those paths on the journey of making that decision that you do focus on the right path, but you need to have thought through all the wrong paths too.
Totally. Yeah. It's almost like you can confidently know the right path because you've like gone down the path already in a way, and you've identified along the way all the false paths, like all the things that are like tempting you to go this way or that way. And you've already determined this isn't the right one. And so then basically in effect, they become closed, right?
Yeah.
And you've like put a wall up on them all.
And I think the more you do something, you know, the more routine it gets and the more, you know, like I said, it's always intense. It's always scary, but you know, the more you do it, it's just, I guess, like any professional athlete that, you know, can't not serve like a tennis serve perfectly. Like that's all they can do, you know?
Right.
There's plenty of ways they can screw up on a serve, but they just keep delivering these 110 mile aces or whatever.
Right.
So I think that's just it. The more you have a routine and the more that you go through the process, you know, it's just the more familiar it gets. And I think that's also part of that equation of being able to, you know, step to the plate and face those kinds of really intense, just mental journeys and obviously physical executions too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sure I will be taking this, this golden path vision into my future decision-making. It's a good visual. So last question, ask everybody this, because hard things are just a part of life. Like they're baked in, especially if you're growing. And so I just like to close things out with what's a hard thing that you're in the middle of right now?
Hard thing in the middle of right now. I would say, I think mentally trying to, you know, like have more of a, like a focus, not try to take on too much. I think I just have a tendency to take on so many projects and wear so many hats that every once in a while they culminate and could just be really overwhelming mentally. I think be able to give yourself space that, if you try to take on too much, you know, I think your life gets challenging to be present when you're with friends and family and your relationship. If you are putting too much emphasis or saying yes to many projects or your professional life, you know, so I think work-life balance is probably my current challenge that I'm facing. And I think, you know, like we're all working through how to balance that correct. And I think I'm learning and continue to learn how to say no, or just, you know, mitigate and manage the variety and quantity of, you know, whether it's professional or just personal interests or creative projects. You know, it's just making sure you have time to be present and just enjoy life every once in a while, not be so occupied with being quote unquote productive, you know?
Right. Yeah. Saying no is hard. Like, especially if it's a good thing that you got to say no to, or at least it appears to be. Yeah. Is it the best thing? Right? Like, that's the better question. So I can resonate with that. I like to have a high capacity. And I think our culture likes to tell us that you should be high capacity. And, you know, it's like you're kind of pushing against that message when you say no to something that seems like a productive, good thing. So that just adds to the difficulty of it. But yeah. Well, in that light, thank you for making some time to spend with us and share your story a little bit. Is, like I said, you're a great storyteller. So that was a fast, you know, hour of time listening, and super grateful for it. How can people keep up with you and you maybe make connect if your story resonated and they got a question, or where's the best place to keep track?
I'd be psyched if they followed along just on my Instagram, Julian Carr. You can also see our mountain races on Instagram, Cirque Series, and you can see all the classic Broncos I've been restoring. I got a little company called Blake Broncos, so check that out too.
Sweet. Yeah, I'll drop all that stuff in the description for people so they can click through to those, and hopefully somebody is encouraged by your story, and I know I was anyway, so that's one, but we'll find some more out there. But Julian, man, thanks for hopping on and spending some time.
You bet, man. I really appreciate the conversation. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Do Hard Things podcast by Elite SRS. We hope you are encouraged today and have a newfound hope to persevere. Be sure to subscribe for more great episodes and conversations. And if you ever want to watch an episode, check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/elitesrs. Have a blessed day.